I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge is a podcast where we bring wise women and a few good men of different generations together into revelatory conversation about what matters most. The Bridge is a project of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. Today, I'm joined in conversation with two incredible global leaders, Mary Robinson and Rachel Kite. Today's guests have fought for women's rights and climate justice across the globe. Through their experiences as leaders and women, they explain why equality for women is a climate issue. Mary Robinson was the first woman president of Ireland and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's now the president of the Mary Robinson Foundation, Climate Justice, and was the founding chair of the Aspen Institute's Global Leaders Council for Reproductive Health, and was the president of Realizing Rights, on which Mary and I worked together for a number of years. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
And Rachel Kite is special representative to the UN Secretary General for Sustainable Energy and CEO of Sustainable Energy for All. And Rachel is a longtime friend of the Institute and a personal hero. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thank you.
So we start all of our Bridge podcasts by asking each of our guests to tell us what generation they're from and some of the key defining moments of that generation. Mary, how would you describe your generation and its defining moments in your own life?
Well, I'm very old, so I'm end of World War II generation, early 70s. And I would say it was an interesting time in the sort of mid-40s to late 40s, because we got a whole lot of positive institutional development at the global level. We got the Charter of the United Nations, we got the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we got the Bretton Woods institutions. The world had learned the horrors of war, two world wars and a Holocaust and the opening up of Cold War and dropping of bombs on Japan, etc. And that was a galvanizing to achieve much more multilateral cooperation. And the Ireland I grew up in was a very traditional Catholic Ireland, and therefore very limiting laws in a number of areas. And also women were very constrained in the space that we were supposed to have, even under the Constitution. The place of the woman was in the home. And I remember when I was growing up and went to boarding school in Dublin and was qualifying from boarding school, graduating, my choices were either to become a nun or to get married. There was a third choice. If I was very creative, I could become an artist or a writer. And I tried that, but somehow I couldn't quite succeed. And so I decided to become a nun. And luckily, the Reverend Mother had the good sense to say that I should maybe go away for a year. And then if I still wanted to be a nun, I could come back. And I went to Paris for a year, and that changed everything, of course. I found that the fact that there were so many laws restricting women and also creating discrimination against gay people, suicide was a crime, it was a very repressive legislation, that it was an interesting time to fight for human rights right from the beginning. I often joke that that was easy for me, because growing up between four brothers, I was conditioned to fight for equality and human rights with my elbows to start with, and my teeth and anything else that I could use on my brothers to assert my equality and human rights. But it was a struggle, and that's how I would define it. And I saw that struggle as more or less moving forward. But changes can come about and rights can go backwards, as we have seen even recently. In a new administration in the United States, and it has happened before. So it's a matter of constant vigilance.
Yeah, thank you, Mary. That's great. That's the first I've ever heard you were going to be a nun, but it's not surprising. Rachel, what generation are you from?
Well, my parents are slightly older than Mary, and I grew up in the United Kingdom, and so I benefited from the extraordinary vision in the UK that came post-war, a National Health Service, a National Education Service. And so I was of that generation of girls who you know, were educated and had, you know, at least on paper, the opportunities that boys did. I talked to my mother about this recently, and she was a bright girl from a lowly background and got a scholarship to, you know, a posh bright girls' school and felt completely out of place for her entire education, and was, you know, framed by a bunch of people telling her she couldn't do this and couldn't do that and couldn't do the other, even though she'd had a sliver of an opportunity. I benefited from standing on the shoulders of all of that. So I came of age with another indomitable woman in power. It was Margaret Thatcher, and that shaped my perspective. It was a time of great social conflict. It was a time of major discussions about peace and war and the environment. You know, nuclear weapons were coming from the United States and being put in Air Force bases down the bottom of our garden. You know, we were completely sure that we would be wiped out if mutually assured destruction ever came to pass. And we looked to Europe at that time for rules on the environment. This is before the European Union started. I mean, there was a whole conversation about what it meant to be European, whether you were living behind the Iron Curtain. So I was shaped by Thatcher's social agenda. That was the first marches that I ever went on. I was shaped by the fall of the Berlin Wall and a sense that Europe could be a common home for everybody. And shaped by the fight for the rights that still weren't granted as a young gay woman. Some of the measures that were introduced by the government in the UK at the time were very punitive, and that was my radicalization.
Right. Thank you. Thanks, Rachel. You know, so this moment we're sitting in right now, you both have alluded to it. We're just coming off the U.S. presidential election and also an incredible global action that followed the women's marches. So there's a lot at stake, obviously, but there's also a renewed sense of mobilization and maybe even perhaps some hope. But the two of you are sitting right in the crosshairs of the greatest battleground issues, climate change and women's rights. So how are you feeling about this moment and really what's to come? Mary, let me start with you.
I try to cling on to a lesson I learned from Archbishop Desmond Tutu. We were involved a few years ago as elders, actually in New York, on a panel in front of young people on social media. And we were being moderated by an American journalist. And of course, when Archbishop Tutu gets in front of young people, he gets even more expressive and excited and speaks to them about love. And, you know, it's wonderful. And the journalist got slightly irritated, I think. And she asked him somewhat sharply, Archbishop Tutu, why are you such an optimist? And he turned to her and he said, oh, no, dearie, I'm not an optimist. I'm a prisoner of hope. And I have to say, I have been struggling for the last while to retain that prisoner of hope idea, the hope, because there is so much to worry about. We don't have time for a leader of a country that is the largest emitter per head and has been a huge emitter in our world to be a climate denier, so-called, for the next 4 years, and to have people in his administration who are not going to move forward and who potentially are going to cut money, funding from the Green Climate Fund and all kinds of things. We just don't have time for that. We need to accelerate in a different direction, and we need a completely different spirit of solidarity and of empathy with the need for developing countries to develop rapidly and get their energy, which Rachel has such huge responsibility for, and there's no time to lose. So it's very hard at the moment to wake up every morning and hear more of this tweeting and this nonsense and this, you know, sort of complete travesty of what the 2030 agenda and the Paris Climate Agreement actually stands for.
Mm. Yeah. Mary, Rachel, how are you feeling about this moment?
Well, I have whiplash because I sort of veer from seething anger at the mean-spiritedness of the agenda that's coming out from so many places, including Washington at the moment, because it's an attack on science and the urgency of the need to act together to restore balance between our economy and the planet. But it's also an attack on women, and it's an attack on immigrants, so it's an attack on the most vulnerable in our society. It's a denial of what is plain in front of our eyes. And so I sort of have a seething resentment and anger around that. And also then, you know, I was taught also by those who helped me in my early years, that, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And so, you know, I have a position of privilege. I have a voice. I have a place where I can have my voice be heard. And whatever scares me in the morning, I've got to get up and get out there and work with others to move it on. Also, as a parent, you know, I just cannot let this be the world that my kids are going to grow up into. And, you know, sometimes you see the fear in their eyes, but certainly the questions are very difficult to answer at the moment that you get from them.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, you were just in Davos last week. Any glimmers of hope there from your perspective?
Well, we can't get participation of women up above, you know, the sort of 18, 19, 20% level, which I find...
At Davos,
which I find completely stupefying. But I thought that in Davos this year, first of all, it was, you know, the pivot east, you know, that China and India and other countries are going to take the leadership mantle as the United States sort of looks inwards and wobbles a little bit. That was very obvious. But I thought what was really interesting when it came to climate change was that, you know, leaders of very important global companies seem to be able to hold two visions of the future in their minds at the same time. On the one hand, they will talk eloquently about decarbonization and the fact that that's what we have to do to the economy and what their role and their opportunities and the risks are for them in doing that. And at the same time, they were able to talk about $40 trillion worth of investment into coal and oil in the next 20 to 25 years. Those are mutually exclusive scenarios, but they were holding both of them. So we haven't quite got to the tipping point that I hope we would get to soon.
You're listening to The Bridge, a podcast by the Aspen Institute. I'm Peggy Clark. Here's the rest of our conversation. Let me turn to both of you. Mary, you're both working in what would be called climate justice, and Mary, you were instrumental in coining that phrase. When did the issue of climate justice first become important to you, Mary?
I think I'm a very late convert to the whole understanding of what climate was doing to our world, what we were doing in the greenhouse gas emissions during my 5 years as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. I did do one thing. I brought human rights and environmental experts together for a consultation in Geneva, a two-day consultation, together with the then head of UNEP. And they issued a very good report, which I submitted to the Human Rights Commission, as it was called at that time. It's now the Human Rights Council. And the Human Rights Commission wouldn't allow it to be published. It was too radical. And you have to remember that the Rio Conference, the Rio Convention in 1992, doesn't have any reference to human rights. In fact, its only reference to people is current and future generations of humankind. That's the only reference to people. Similarly, the year after that, in 1993, we had the World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna, and there was no reference to the environment. So I could spend my 5 years working on human rights, because in another part of the UN, somebody was working on environment and on climate, the UNFCCC and UNEP in Nairobi. And that was the siloed approach that I now see as a big problem, and we've got to try and break it down as much as possible. I came to understand the impacts of climate because of its impact on people, the people that you and I were trying to work with in that organization that I headed, and you were my managing director in the initial stages, Peggy, Realizing Rights. And we were working in African countries on issues of women, peace and security, of right to health, of corporate responsibility, of right to food. And I was also honorary president of Oxfam, and Oxfam were wheeling me out in different places, which was also useful for us. And everywhere I went, I heard this expression, things are so much worse. And when I unpacked it with the person who was saying it, it wasn't about conflict so much, though it did figure in different places. It was more consistently about, we can't understand why everything has changed in the weather pattern. We don't know when it's going to rain, when our rainy seasons will come. We've had long periods of drought and flash flooding. We never had that before. We can't predict. Our harvest is wiped out all over Africa. And that was, you know, the year 2002 we started, about 2003, 2004, this was very consistent and getting worse. And then I read the science and I realized how serious this was and that it was a huge human rights issue, which at the time people didn't seem to see. And we worked then more and more in a climate justice context, including in Cancun when we formed a troika of women leaders on gender and climate. And I'm delighted that Rachel is one of the members of that troika. And it was an idea of, you know, using our access to the table as ministers, as heads of agencies, and the foundation that I founded when I came back to Ireland, my foundation on climate justice became the secretariat. And we now link with grassroots women and helped to get their voices into the global plan of action, which people are working on gender in the climate context. I think it's interesting that we now see much more focus on the human dimensions, usually under the kind of banner of climate justice. I was very pleased to see it in the women's marches, although not just in the United States, but around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. No, Mary, that's true. And then also, I think I remember you when you became a grandmother. One of the first things you always said was that gave you a completely different perspective on the climate issue. And Rachel, what about you? You have been working on this issue for much of your life. When were you first aware of this issue of the importance of climate justice?
So I think I was a little slow on the uptake as well. And I worked at the World Bank. I worked at the International Finance Corporation and then the World Bank for a number of years. And one of the extraordinary privileges of working in an institution like that is you do get to see and to talk to and to be in places that you wouldn't normally. And I remember I was responsible for climate change and sort of infrastructure and disaster relief and everything. And I was trying to sort of say, look, you know, what's the theory of change here? What's the whole? Because everybody seemed to be sort of siloed and not really thinking through things. And a number of the most developing countries, the least developed, were asking us, look, you know, we need help with our adaptation to the impacts of climate, but we don't know what we should be adapting to. Is it going to be 1 degree of warming or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6? Because people tell us that at 6 it's going to be disastrous, at 4 it's bad, at 2. What should we expect? And so we asked, we commissioned climate scientists, the Potsdam Institute, to come in, and we overlaid their climate science projections with economic development data and started building up a picture of what's going to be the economic impact of the science, of what the science projects. And meanwhile, Mary was in my ear, climate justice, human rights, and and there was, of course, this groundswell of justice framed issues coming from civil society and from different countries, including the most vulnerable, the Pacific Islands, etc. And suddenly this all sort of started to come together, and it was like, okay, here's incontrovertible evidence that those who are least able to take care of their own resilience are going to be hit the hardest. And for no reason other than an accident of geography and history, that they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And you know, the injustice just washed right over you. I mean, it was extraordinary when you started looking at this from that perspective. And then, you know, and then I had the opportunity to sit down with communities that were being absolutely ravaged by changes of rain patterns, changes in heat, and what it was doing to their crops. Communities that were being buffeted by Category 5 cyclones. And you can't look away. You cannot look away. And I think the thing that really hit me the hardest was that every day that we decide to just keep on going as if it is business as usual, we are condemning other people to an injustice. So our actions are not benign, right? So it's not that, oh, we have to choose to do something. By choosing to not do something, we are condemning other people to a future that they didn't choose and that they have no control over.
So, well, Rachel, if I could just come in for a moment. I know, please. You've moved on from the World Bank, though you have a link, as you know, you're still a link from a climate and energy, renewable energy point of view. But the World Bank, as I understand it, is still actually supporting fossil fuel development.
Yeah, well, I read a report last night that would indicate that one of their lending instruments seems to be having that impact. I haven't gone over the data. I haven't talked to my former colleagues. We will do. But I think that the speed with which we need to move through the energy transition, the speed with which we have to decarbonize our energy system is extraordinarily urgent. And it's every country is in a transition. Every country has to go from where they are today to where they need to be. But the case is incontrovertible that we have to decarbonize. So I look forward to getting into that with them.
Yeah. What I did like, just to talk about, the need for more ambition and urgency, as you've said, and I fully agree with you, I was very pleased in Marrakesh with the Marrakesh vision of the Climate Vulnerable Forum. I'm sure you
saw
that.
Yeah, I was there. It was incredible.
Said, I thought that was wonderful because they are the most vulnerable countries, and they said, we have to make sure we get to that 1.5 and don't go above that so that we will continue to survive and not be completely either underwater if we're a small island or completely destroyed by the severe climate shocks because of where we are and our vulnerability to climate.
And it's not just the smallest islands. I mean, as we're recording this, Mary, right, Chile, which is a member of the Climate Vulnerability Forum, is going through the most extraordinary forest fires, with extraordinary heats being recorded in different towns. So I think that it isn't over there happening to somebody we've never met. It's happening here now, and it's our neighbours, right?
Yeah, I thought it was very well put at the discussion in the UN last September on migration and refugees, when the head of the IOM, Bill Swing, said there are 75 million people worldwide who live in coastal regions 1 meter or less above sea level.
Wow.
That's very frightening.
Incredible.
That's
very frightening.
And as you say, and a lot of that is Miami and other cities in New York, not just elsewhere.
Hi, I'm Tricia Johnson, host of Aspen Ideas to Go, a podcast from the Aspen Institute. Each week, we feature onstage discussions from Institute events like the Aspen Ideas Festival. Listen as journalist Tom Friedman explains how to live in an age of dizzying accelerations. Or learn how treating your gut right can lead to a healthier you. Aspen Ideas to Go covers a broad range of topics and opens your mind to new ways of thinking and living. Find the podcast by searching Aspen Ideas to Go on iTunes. Now, back to The Bridge from the Aspen Institute.
Listening to you both, it's extraordinary to me when I think about you both sitting in this intersection of spending so much of your life working on women's rights and human rights in general, and then climate change right now. So let's turn back to reproductive rights for a moment. Both of you have played enormous roles in the movement. Rachel, you were a policy advisor for the International Women's Health Coalition at the 4th Women's Conference in Beijing. Mary, you've advocated for reproductive health rights and access both in the courtroom, in your early life, legislation, advocacy, your earliest battles as a senator in a very Catholic country. Just shifting for a moment, Mary, when did you first become aware of sort of the fragility of reproductive rights in your own life?
Well, I realized when I came back from studying in the Harvard Law School, I was the class of 1968. So I came back to Ireland in the summer of 1968, full of Harvard, what my beloved husband-to-be called my Harvard Law School humility. I was full of determination that young people could really make change, as I was seeing, because I was part of a great class of 1968. They were going into civil rights movement. We had had great discussions on what the meaning of law and morality and goodness knows what. And I was very fired up when I came back to Ireland. And it was evident that the law was ridiculous, because married women could only avail of the contraceptive pill in Ireland at the time if they had cycle regulation problems. And we used to joke that it must be the weather or something, that so many married women had cycle regulation problems and therefore could have the pill. And secondly, it wasn't against the law to use a condom, but it was against the criminal law to either buy or sell a condom. again, just it didn't seem logical. And it was that kind of approach I was taking. I drafted with two fellow senators a simple bill, which we introduced in 1970. I got elected to the Senate in 1969, the upper house in Ireland. And in 1970, we tried to introduce a private member's bill to legalize the availability of contraception and to change attitudes. Of course, we completely underestimated how deep the attitudes were. I was immediately denounced. I received hate mail. I was denounced by newspapers. And the then Catholic Archbishop of Dublin required a letter to be read out in every Catholic church in Dublin saying that this measure, meaning the bill that I was proposing, would be and would remain a curse upon the country. Simple, you know, and I was 26 at that stage or going on 27, and it was heavy stuff. And I remember being very, very affected, actually wobbling, and so much so that Nick destroyed the hate mail that we got, which is a pity because we're both archivists and we regret that some of that material is no longer there, you know. I was very affected by suddenly turning from being, you know, quite an admired person within my own circle, not terribly well known, but admired, to a hate figure nationally. And I've often spoken to young people about this and said, you know, if you really believe in something, be prepared to pay a price. Just, you know, be prepared to be steady and go ahead with it. Not arrogantly, but if you really are convinced that the change needs to happen. And no other steps that I had to take or fights that I had to fight were as difficult as that one. I think I got the scar tissue on that one.
Tough skin. That's a really incredible story, Mary. Rachel, what about you? When were you first in your life aware of the fragility of reproductive rights?
Well, I think I was 14 or 15, and one of my close friends at high school became pregnant and was sort of whisked off to another part of the country for a few weeks. And this was Britain, where, you know, things were nowhere near as bad as Ireland. But, you know, a hush fell across, you know, my all-girls high school. And there's the shame was, I just remember the sort of this cloak of shame over everything and everybody. But then I was the vice chair of the British Youth Council a few years later. And there, as the vice chair for participation, one of the big issues was taking care of the large numbers of young Irish women who were coming over to London to seek reproductive health care and to seek abortion. And this was a big issue at a time where things were still, it was still a subject of debate, still a subject of huge conflict in the UK. And then fast forward to the 1994 Conference on Population Development and then the following year, the Fourth Women's World Conference in Beijing. And I had the great honour to work for a woman called Joan Dunlop, who had founded the International Women's Health Coalition. And she was this most unlikely and extraordinary figure. Had grown up from a wealthy background in the UK and sort of run away on a boat rather than be a debutante, and had been a secretary for all kinds of powerful men and had worked her way up. And she was one of the first women I ever met that understood how power worked, understood how money worked, and understood how sex worked, where the power lies. And she, we ran an extraordinary campaign to have women's reality and women's lives be recognized in those UN documents, and got path-breaking language on reproductive health and rights and sexual health. And the number of women from everywhere, from Vietnam and Indonesia to Bolivia to Mexico, who would come and say, you know, this language, you know, gives us strength because now we can argue at home for the basic rights to healthcare that we deserve. When you see how fundamental it is for a woman's dignity to be able to protect her own body and what happens to it, then I think you don't step back from that.
Let's link these two issues. You both have been involved in running through the halls and standing firm for the inclusion of reproductive health rights and women's leadership within the various versions of climate change documents. So tell me a little bit about that work, Mary. When we were in Durban, the climate talks in Durban, you and a group of women were instrumental in including that. Can you make the link between this issue of women's reproductive rights and climate change?
I think if we think of it in terms of the impact of climate change on, that it has a huge gender impact. It's not gender neutral, which is what the Rio conference thought it was in 1992. Gender neutral is gender blind. You don't see it. But actually, if you're undermining by climate disruption, by unpredictability, by severe impacts of severe drought, severe flooding, it has a different impact on the ground of women and men. And it is much more burdensome on women, particularly at local level. And then that translates to women's traditional role, women's access to family planning, access to reproductive health, not having electricity, and so many deaths taking place because the candle blew out or the woman didn't have a candle. Just the whole reality on the ground of the fact that there is a huge gender dimension to climate change itself. And with the elders, I'm involved at the moment in a campaign that we've highlighted. We're also very strong on climate change, but we've chosen of the Sustainable Development Goals to particularly highlight access to health for all. And the elders are very concerned about this reinstalling of the Mexico,
The gag rule.
The gag. So the elders are going to issue a statement, which Gru Brundtland and myself will speak to. I've finalised my text. She hasn't done hers yet. It will go out, I hope, in the next couple of days. We've been asked to sort of sign on to other attempts to protest this. And why? Why is it so important? Because actually, this is really about the most fundamental women and girls' rights. It's about maternal health. It's about reproductive health. It's about child health. It's about early child marriage. It's about all of those things that if you cut off the funding from the organizations that are involved in all of this, the situation will become even worse. We will have far more what I deliberately describe as botched abortions, because it's such a horrible phrase, and it shows how horrible the reality is for women who have these backstreet botched abortions. And so many women in developing countries die from botched abortions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Mary. So let's move to a different question. The Bridge podcast is predicated on this belief that we have so much to learn from each other across generations. So, Mary, what's one question you have for Rachel?
I was very struck by the strength of the women's marches in response to the inaugural address of President Trump, and the fact that those marches took place in different parts of the world. So I kind of would like to ask Rachel, building a little bit on what we've been saying in this podcast, how can we build on the women's marches and create a broader women's movement with support from men, of course, and young people in particular, on rights, development and climate issues, on women's rights, development and climate issues? I don't think it's been done in that sort of way before, that you have many women who champion part of that, who champion women's health, who champion reproductive health, who champion women's rights in an economic sense, who champion climate issues. But this seemed to me to be the opportunity for a broader umbrella, but how to sustain. I know there's going to be another global march on the 29th of April in the United States, and it will be mirrored in other cities in the world. But what's the change agent that will help us? You used that expression earlier, I noted, that will help us to make this a real movement.
Well, that's a really good question. I think that I marched in Washington along with 1.2 million other people, and with my mother-in-law and with my daughter, my partner, and so we were a multi-generational group. And I think that the answer lies in what happened the next day when I went to the supermarket. And there was this sort of like, and I live in a deeply democratic part of the country. So it's not the reality for many other people. But there were, it's like there was a secret look. You looked at people in the eye, and it was like, you marched, didn't you? Yes, I marched. And a kid came running up to me and saw that we'd still got a sticker on the back of the car that would indicate that maybe we had marched. And this little kid, a 10-year-old boy, came up and said, my mom wants to know if you marched. And I said, yes, and my children marched as well. And then the mother came over and she goes, how can we keep it going? And so that's in the supermarket car park. And I think the answer is at the local level, but it is nurses and community health workers and teachers, Republican and Democrat and independent in this country, who understand what's at risk from withdrawing healthcare, who understand what's at risk from the change in the weather patterns and the stress on the land, who understand what happens when the water becomes contaminated or the water starts running dry. And I think that if we can find a way, and of course, I have to say, in this country, the communities of faith who really get this. And so it's going to be in the local pulpit, the local Bema, it's going to be in the church hall, the school, in the healthcare center, that's where the intersectionality that we like to call has to come together. And there I put my faith in the generation below us, because I think that they get it. And we have to, I feel that my role now is to do everything I can to support the women leaders and activists who are a wee bit younger than me, and come in behind them and bring every piece of wisdom and advice I can to them, and let them really run with us.
Absolutely. That's great, Rachel.
I fully agree with everything that Rachel has said, and particularly the younger generation, and we're the wise voices, hopefully, and encouragement.
Rachel, let me turn to you with a final question. What's a hope that you have for Mary's generation?
So this is a generation of remarkable women who, between the 40s and today, so in that 70 plus years, have seen a world that has changed beyond recognition in a way that no other generation that has come before has ever seen. So this is the generation that's gone from no technology to trying to figure out how to use their cell phone and asking their grandchildren to help them, right? This is a generation of women who had to get retrained at work because the technology kept changing again and again and again. This is the generation of women who had no rights and have now got close to lots of rights. Exercising them is another thing. And so what I ask from that generation is for them to continue to give their blessing and their love to those who are coming behind, to tell their stories, to find the humor and the strength in each other, to keep on standing tall. Each one of them has got a remarkable story of progress, rapid progress, transformative progress. And I think that humility with a capital H, but that bolshiness that generation has the right to hold close is very much needed at the moment. My mother-in-law, not known for marching, put a sign around her neck saying, "I am a nasty woman." And just behind us was a group of Reform Jewish women saying, you know, all Jewish women are nasty. And that's the strength and the resilience that this generation, Mary's generation, have, that we need to tap into.
Beautiful. Thank you, Rachel. It's been an honor to be with you both today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for listening to The Bridge, a production of the Aspen Institute. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, The Bridge from the Aspen Institute, or on your favorite podcast app. I'm Peggy Clark, and thanks again for listening.